Welcome to 4000 Saturdays Life Insights, an inspiring dialogue about life and humanity's big questions with some of today's leading visionaries, thinkers, teachers, and authors. I'm your host, Mark DeVoe, and on this dialogue, I'm truly delighted to have as my guest, Chris Johnston. Chris is a specialist in the psychology of change and addiction, and author of the highly rated book, Find Your Power, one of the few books to address both personal and planetary concerns. Chris has also worked with Joanna Macy and is editor of The Great Turning Times. Chris, hello.
Hi, Mark.
Thanks very much for joining us today, Chris.
It's a pleasure.
Now, Chris, I first came across you in a book called Be the Change, which is a fantastic book, which highlighted a number of very, very interesting people on our planet today who are doing very inspiring and encouraging things. And I was particularly taken by your story in terms of how, you know, your journey so far has taken you to what you do today. Could you give people a bit of background in a nutshell as to what you do and how you what you're actually up to at the moment as a result of this journey that you've personally been on?
Yes, I find it hard to describe myself because I do a number of different things. But if I was to have one term, it would be that I'm a positive visionologist. And what I mean by that is that I focus on how we find positive visions that excite us, and then also how we take active roles in moving towards them. And that sometimes people have ideas in their mind of, you know, wouldn't it be good if, and wouldn't it be good if changes in their personal life, changes in their workplace or organisations they work for, and also looking at the bigger picture of our world, wouldn't it be good if so many changes we can think of. But then what often happens is that there's part of our mind, and I think of it as the blocker part, that says, well, you can't do that. You can't do that because, and people have kind of ideas like you can't change the world, or you can't change yourself, you can't change your personality. There's even expressions like a leper can't change its spots. And that there's ways of thinking that can lead us to feel pessimistic about the possibility of positive change. And my work is about helping people tackle the kinds of internal blocks in terms of emotions and thinking that get in the way of positive change. I work in the health service as an addiction specialist, so I'm dealing there with personal change, but I also work with organisations in terms of improving well-being in the workplace. And I do a lot of work with people who are concerned about what's happening in our world and who'd like to increase their capacity to take part in active positive changes.
So Chris, what would you say that when you talk to people, what do you say is the common thing that you seem to hear coming up about people's concerns for the world?
Well, one of the biggest things that I hear is a sense of despondency, defeat, and disillusion. And it's like the sense that we really can make an act of change. It's like some people have that sense, but a lot of people don't. And to the point where they say, what's the point of even looking at the bad news, because you can't do anything about it anyway. And I find that idea is so common. But also what it comes down to is our own internal sense of what's within our power and what's beyond our power. And if we feel that it's beyond our power to really have much influence in the world or to have much effect on the world, then it becomes a kind of a heart sink area to look at concerns about the world. As soon as you start to think about your concerns of the world, that there's a part of the brain that says, well, there's no point even thinking about that because you can't do anything about it anyway. And what I'm really interested in is, what is our sense of what's within our power, what's beyond our power? How do we decide that? How do we work out what we can change or what we can't change? And what I'm really interested in is how our sense of what's possible is based on our way of thinking about things. And that if we change our way of thinking about things, how that opens up whole new doors in terms of what's possible.
That's really fascinating, Chris. And I think I'd be quite interested to hear about what was the pinpoint moment for you which turned some of your focus towards some of the bigger pictures issues in our world. Can you remember an event in your life where maybe you woke up to the problems that were happening?
Well, there've been a number of points in my life where I think of them as switching on moments. I did an O level in environmental studies, and that was years and years ago when I was a teenager. And that part of our studies was looking at, like, why do you get rivers full of dead fish? You know, I just remember seeing these pictures with just rivers and rivers just full of dead fish after industrial poisoning episodes. And I just got really interested in that because I used to be fascinated by pond life when I was a kid, and then seeing times where you'd come across rivers and streams that have been polluted, and just kind of saying, well, you know, why is this happening? But another major kind of, I think of them as the inciting moments. Another inciting moment was when I was training as a doctor. I spent some time in Sri Lanka. And I was working at a centre for abandoned malnourished children. And I just remember holding this 2-year-old child that had arms and legs like matchsticks, you know, just it's still a really clear memory with me. And just being really shocked by the reality of human starvation. And this happens, you know, day in, day out. There's something like tens of thousands, perhaps 30,000 children who die every day because they don't have the basic necessities of life, that they don't have adequate food, adequate nutrition, and safe water supplies. And just being really shocked by that, particularly living in a rich industrialized country where that kind of thing doesn't happen, certainly not in any way near the same kind of scale or visibility. And that left me with a deep, heartfelt conviction that I wanted to be part of a positive response to that.
That's it's interesting that you mentioned that. I think a lot of people that have had these experiences, especially in third world countries, it does tend to act as a almost like a benchmark for the rest of their life. Have you found that with your own life?
Yes, and what was really interesting with this is that, I mean, that was in 1984 that, and I was a medical student, and you know, I'd really made the decision, okay, I want my life to be a positive response to what's happening in our world. But another inciting moment was 4 years later. I went to a workshop, and it was a workshop around giving people space to experience their emotional reactions to what was happening in the world. And we did a kind of like a circle of grieving. It was called a cairn of mourning, where we were given opportunity to mourn for what we grieve for in our world, what was being lost in our world. And there are species becoming extinct every day. There are tens of thousands of children dying from starvation. There are forests being chopped down. I mean, there's so much, this kind of endless catalogue of things that we are losing in our world, the beauty of our natural environment. So many things. And so we had space just to grieve together. And I just spent a whole afternoon crying, and I'd never really cried like that before. And I would say that's another one of those pivotal moments, because what happened then, it was like that information about children starving, it had somehow been accepted at a head level, but I hadn't really digested the emotional significance of that. And that was a deepening of my level of conviction. And what that weekend did for me is it was an example of how when you give space for the emotional reaction, that there's a kind of a deeper level of acceptance that can happen with things. And that I left that weekend feeling kind of like supercharged with determination. You know, my kind of levels of motivation really rose. And it convinced me that our psychological reactions to what's happening in the world is one of the often missed ingredients when we look at tackling world problems. And that when we make room to allow the emotional reactions, there's an incredible store of energy that can be tapped into in a way that people can use to mobilize their responses to concerns about the world.
That's fantastic. I mean, in terms of this, you mentioned about this grieving process that you went through. Do you believe that you almost had to go through or have that experience in order to get this supercharged emotion of motivation to want to make a change? Do you see the two as completely connected?
Yes, I do. And that weekend, after that weekend, what I was left with was a kind of feeling of life purpose, really. I felt like somehow I'd found a missing piece of the jigsaw, And that I decided I wanted to train myself to run workshops like this. And I mean, that was over 20 years ago now. And I became an apprentice to the people who are running those workshops, particularly a woman called Pat Fleming. And I did a lot of work with someone called Joanna Macy, who I've worked very closely with really for about 20 years now. And I've been running those kind of workshops. And over a decade ago, I did a follow-up study. I sent questionnaires to people a year after they'd been to a workshop with me. And I just said, look, you did this workshop with me a year ago. Can you just answer some questions about what effect it's had on your life? And what was really striking was that over 90% of the people said that they felt strengthened in their belief that they could make a difference in the world just from attending a weekend workshop over a year ago. What was also striking was that people had also found the experience of the workshop personally healing. And I think this is where there's something about when we feel really concerned about something, but those feelings of concern have nowhere to go. They just end up getting kind of shut off. And the more we shut off our emotional reactions to things, it can lead to a gradual kind of closing down of our psychological energy. And I've, in my experience of running these workshops, lots of people who've been to workshops I've ran have had similar experience to the workshop I went to, where they've had a kind of an emotional release that's led to a state of much higher energy afterwards.
And in terms of the process that people have gone through, I mean, Rob Hopkins from Transition Networks talks about this concept of post-petroleum stress disorder, which you're probably familiar with. Have you found something similar that happens in these workshops, a kind of a tipping point almost, where people suddenly realized the life that they believed that they were living was maybe a dream, and they've kind of woken up to the realities of what's going on?
Absolutely. There's somebody who's written a book on grief counselling, J. William Warden. It's called Grief Counselling. He talks about stages of grief, but also tasks of grieving. And one of the first tasks of grieving is to accept the reality of the loss. And part of accepting the reality of the loss, I mean, there's different sides of it. One is kind of accepting it as an intellectual reality, like, oh yes, I know that that's happened. But there's also feeling the pain of loss, and that's the second task in his grieving process, that when you feel the pain of loss, it's part of what makes it real. And without feeling the pain of loss, sometimes it's like the loss hasn't really sunk in. And I'm sure lots of people may have the experience of knowing somebody who's lost somebody, but it's like they're although they kind of accept on a kind of intellectual level that the loss has happened, it's like they're acting as though it hasn't happened. And I think this can happen with all of us. We can all know that people are dying from starvation. We can all know that species are becoming extinct every year. We can all know that the weather's becoming more disturbed. But it can somehow be shut in a little compartment in our brain, in a way that's kind of distant, and the full significance hasn't really sunk in. And I feel this particularly when I work with parents who often have tremendous fears about what kind of world their children are growing up in. And some of them have said to me, they said, Chris, I can't carry these feelings around. I don't know what to do with them. There's just too much. So I shut it away and I shut down. And my experience of working with people is that if you can provide a safe environment to be with the distress that's there, it allows it to be. It's not like you work through with it and deal with it and suddenly you're happy that the world's in a complete disaster state. It's more that you feel the pain in a way that you accept what's going on, and then you can have a deepened level of conviction of finding your response to that.
And it seems that within that process lies some of the answers to moving people through this cycle that we see with the issues of climate change, obviously peak oil, and all the other overwhelmingly scary things that people are having to face in their lives. Do you think that almost there needs to be a grieving on a kind of a large scale within the world before people will start moving as a community towards tackling some of the issues in their own lives?
I think there does need to be a collective process of awakening to a new reality. And I'll say a bit what I mean by that, that you talked about people having their kind of reality, find that it's not accurate. And I think there are different stories we can have about what's happening in our world. One is, I think of as the business as usual story. The business as usual story is that basically things are fine. You get upsets here and there. You get periods of recession and periods of recovery. But basically things tend to bumble along in pretty much the same old way. And in that story of business as usual, there's often an assumption that the way forward is economic growth. And so that's what governments and large organizations tend to be committed to. But there's another reality, which is a kind of, I think of as our world's falling apart reality, the kind of our world is unraveling. And when people get into that story, then suddenly all of this kind of business as usual just doesn't really make sense. There's a kind of collapse of the illusion. And sometimes people can get so caught in the story of unraveling that it can all seem too much. It can seem that it's all falling apart and we can't do anything. And that's where I think we need a third story. And I think of the third story, I call it the great turning. And I'm very much influenced here by my work as an addiction specialist in the health service, that one of the stages people go through in addictions recovery is a kind of, it's called hitting bottom. Hitting bottom is when they crash into the feelings of alarm and distress and the pain of their situation that becomes so strong that it kind of shocks them into awakeness, where they say, I've got to change this. I can't carry on this way. And it's a painful process, but it's also a turning point. And I think that's what's needed. It's like we need the painful realization that business as usual is leading us astray. Business as usual is leading us on a collision course with disaster. But at the same time, it's not just that everything's falling apart and it's all hopeless and we can't do anything. That's the second story of unraveling. It's we need a third story, which is of crisis can become a turning point. And that when we really get into that third story and start living from that place of we are living at a crucial period in human history, we are living at the time where we are realizing how completely off course we've got, how we're heading for a crisis, but also I think humans can be incredibly creative and ingenious, and that we take part in a process, a collective process of transition and turning towards a realistic, sustainable future. And that needs, it can happen on an individual level, but it also needs to happen on a community level. It needs to happen on a much larger collective level. And that when it happens collectively, it becomes a much more empowering and community building process. If it's only happening on an individual level, we can still feel somehow kind of cut off, that it's too big. And I just think of a saying in the addictions recovery world. They say, I can't, we can. And it's the same when addressing challenges in our world. There's that sense of, I can't, this is too big for me. But if we see ourselves as part of a much larger process of transition and turning, then it becomes possible. And that's the we can.
And it's very interesting that you use the analogy of a addiction within some of the problems that we face today. And having read your book, Find Your Power, you talk about addiction being linked with the consumption problem and the role that materialism plays in our kind of post. What links do you make between the work that you've done with drug users and alcohol users and other forms of addiction and the addiction that we have as a consumptive or an overconsumptive society?
Well, for me, my work in the addictions field has been a training ground that really gives me a lot of sense of optimism about the possibility of breaking free of stuck patterns of behavior that are destructive, because that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a stuck pattern of behavior that's destructive. And I think sometimes people have problems with the word addiction, that it seems almost like too strong a word, or it conjures up images of being out of control. But we are out of control. There's a whole process of setting limits to reduce traffic, setting limits to reduce carbon emissions, that we keep kind of setting limits and failing in those limits, in the same way that somebody who might try and tackle their alcohol use might set limits and fail in those limits. And I think maybe rather than addiction, I think that the term dependence syndrome is useful. And dependence is where we become accustomed to a particular way of behaving or a particular pattern of consumption in a way where there's a disturbance that happens when that substance or behavior isn't available anymore. So, for example, I think a really good parallel is in oil consumption, that we've become accustomed to very high levels of oil consumption. And all it takes is that just happened some years ago when there were the disputes about oil deliveries, and there was a reduction in oil supply and availability, and it created a kind of real sense of panic in some senses that we are so dependent on high levels of consumption that we haven't even thought about how we're really going to survive when oil becomes less available. And that's certainly the direction that we're heading in, that we're depleting our world's oil supplies. So I think that there's a lot of parallels that I've come across in my addictions work. But what I'm particularly find fruitful is that there are proven treatments that help people with addiction problems, and approaches like motivational interviewing particularly. We can apply a lot of the insights of approaches that are proven to be useful in the addictions field to tackling our oil consumption. And that's where I've worked very closely with Rob Hopkins in the Transitions Initiatives, in looking at how we wean ourselves off our dependence on oil.
One area that I find fascinating is this analogy. Actually, if you go back 20, 30 years, or in the 60s, really, when a lot of people were smoking and not really understanding the health implications of what they were doing, do you think there's an analogy there that we can take forward into the future, and that we're kind of in that situation at the moment, and that at a top level we realize that there is an addiction to oil? You hear Obama talking about having to break an addiction to oil, so it's out there in the mainstream now. But do you feel that on an individual level we don't yet see the connection between, say, the smoker and the tobacco, so they don't see themselves as addicted to the oil as such, or addicted to the tobacco itself? Is there an interesting analogy to draw there?
Absolutely. And one of the ideas I find very helpful in the addictions field is called the stages of change model. And it's looking at this idea that change doesn't happen all at once. It happens in a process that moves through different areas. And before we make a change, we tend to make a decision to make a change. And before we make a decision to make a change, we tend to think about it. And before we think about a change, there will be a period of our time, period of our lives, when we weren't even thinking about it. And I think in relation to tackling oil consumption, most people in industrialized countries are not even really thinking about tackling their oil dependence. It's not really out there in the public arena. I think people are thinking about energy use in terms of climate change, but there isn't an awareness of how close we are to oil depletion. And I think that's changing, really largely thanks to the transition movements. It's done a lot to make people aware of peak oil, this idea that there will come a time where we can't just keep on pumping out the same amount of oil. And as you move into the second half of an oil field's life, you reach the kind of peak of production in an oil field. And after that, each year the oil field will be producing less each year. And that's the situation we have with North Sea oil now. We're past the peak of production. We're past the peak of production in oil in the United States some decades ago. In fact, most oil producing countries are past their peak of production. And some people argue that we're at the stage now where world oil supplies are about at their peak, and then it's going to start falling. That's not common knowledge. And as it becomes common knowledge, people are then going to start moving into the thinking about stage. And we need to move very rapidly into the preparation and action stage. There's been such high levels of denial of this at a very high level. And we need to be working together on this now.
So, Chris, take us through step by step these stages of change.
Well, you use a parallel with smoking, that somebody may have a period of their life where they're a contented smoker. They're not thinking about changing it. They're quite happy with their tobacco use. And then something may happen that causes them to think twice. It may be someone they know gets a serious tobacco-related illness. It may be they get a really bad chest infection. It may be they're just sick and tired of having a morning cough. Maybe that they're going up some stairs and they feel short of breath in a way that surprises them. Something happens that gets them starting to think, maybe this isn't such a good idea. And so then they move from the pre-contemplation stage into the contemplation stage. And what can happen is that we can stay for years where we're just thinking about a change, and sometimes we're more interested and sometimes we're less interested. And you can even get what I think of as a flip-flop zone, where you decide one day and then don't decide the next day. But a certain point will come where you say, that's it, that's enough. And when you make that decision, I'm going to tackle this, you move from the thinking about stage into a preparation stage. Preparation is different from actually tackling it. It's just saying, I'm now willing to start looking at this. And that we tend to spend some time preparing for a change, looking at how we're going to make it before we make it. And then once you've made a change, that's moving to the action stage. But also with any change, there's forwards and backwards. There's two different directions in change, that you can make a change and then unmake it. Lots of people give up smoking and then start again. So one of those stages is relapse. And in order to prevent a relapse, the final stage of change is called the maintenance stage. And that's where you look at consolidating your progress and anchoring it. So in relation to tackling global issues, I think large numbers of people, most people, certainly the polls show this, most people are concerned about climate change. Most people have got the message that it is happening and it is related to human activity. But also, and then looking at the steps people are willing to make, most people are willing to make steps like changing light bulbs, beginning to look at their energy patterns, but also in terms of seriously addressing, say, car use or aviation. Probably there's certainly huge numbers of people who are in the not even thinking about stage of change. And so part of the work really is about raising awareness of the problem, but also becoming aware of the blocks to change at every step along this journey. And this is where the insights in the addictions field are really, really useful, because what you're working with in addictions recovery work is resistance to change counterbalanced by enthusiasm for change. And you're looking at what promotes enthusiasm for change, and also what promotes confidence that change is possible. Somebody can see a change is important, but if they don't believe it's possible, that becomes a block that they get stuck at. And so in these stages of change, it's kind of looking at where are people, what stage of change are they at, but also what's the block they're bumping into, what's the obstacle they're bumping into, and how do you help people over that?
So where would you say that society generally is in terms of that stage of awareness?
Well, I would say that in relation to climate change, we're somewhere, and people will vary in this, somewhere between contemplation, preparation, and action. And some people are much further ahead of that, and they've made the changes and they're maintaining them. And a smaller proportion of people are also at the stage where they don't even believe it's happening. But I'd say most people now have got the message, that there are really serious problems that we need to address, and they're looking for how we can find a way of dealing with them. But I think also what they bump into, the obstacle, and I'd see this as one of the biggest obstacles, is around confidence that we can really make a difference. And that's why I wrote my book, Find Your Power, because it's looking at how do we find our power to make a difference? How do we recognize that tackling global issues is within our power rather than beyond it? And that it's really recognizing that our ability to reach a goal is influenced not just by what that goal is, but also how we think about it and how we feel about it, and that we can train ourselves to become better equipped to make the large changes that are needed in our times.
That there seems to be an idea in conversations that a lot of people are having that people as a whole won't actually make the changes necessary until it's too late. And talking about the accepted reality of loss that you talked about, the idea that you have to kind of grieve the loss. How much of a issue do you think that plays within this human story that we're discussing in terms of whether human change will happen before climate change really is goes beyond the tipping point.
Well, I hear that. I hear that argument, and I also hear it in the addictions work as well. And certainly there, in my work in the addictions field, I have clients who get well every year. So we know that it is possible for people to change before it's too late. I see that happening every week. But also, I get clients who die every year. Clients I've worked with closely, have come to know well. I hear about how they've died from the results of their addictive behavior. And so I think it could go either way. And this is where I think it gets really interesting, because the key question here is, what do we want to happen? If what we want to happen is that we wake up in time, then let's become part of that process. I think the danger is if we kind of say things like, well, it's not going to happen, the trouble with humans is they're stuck in their way, in a way where it's not going to change, so it's hopeless. I'd say, what's the effect of thinking that way? And one of the dangers of thinking that way is that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I know people who say, well, the problem with climate change is it's too late already, so what's the point? And what they're doing there is they're telling a story that blocks their response. We don't know whether it's too late. What we do know is that the more we leave it and the more that we continue the way we're going, the worse it's going to get. That's very, very clear. And so what I'm interested in is, well, how do we become part of the story of change? And there's certain principles here that help. And one of the principles I find helpful is move from they should to I will. So taking that principle, move from they should to I will, for anyone who's saying, oh, it's too late, people aren't going to change, well, I say, well, if you apply that to yourself, are you saying for yourself that it's too late for you to change? What might make it easier for change? I think that's where we get into a much more interesting conversation. We're saying, what would help you change? And this idea of the great turning, will the great turning happen in time? What I'm interested in is how I can become part of the great turning, because I know that if I can change, I know that it's possible. And I know that I struggle with my own resistances to change. There's attachments to comfort that I have, that there are some things I'm kind of a bit slow in letting go of. But I also know that I've made steps that I see working for a positive future for our world is right at the core of my purpose in life. And I know that's true of so many other people as well. And the more and more we put ourselves behind the story of positive change, the more that's likely to happen. And it is kind of, I think of it as like a kind of holistic democracy. In an electoral democracy, you get one vote every few years. But in a holistic democracy, every one of your life choices is like a vote for the kind of future you want to see happen. And we get loads of votes every day. Every day we get opportunities to put our lives behind our preferred possible future. And that's what I want to vote for. I have a very clear preferred possible future, and it involves humans finding a way through. And that's what I want to put my life behind.
Join me, Mark DeVoe, for part two of this dialogue with Chris Johnston, which you can find at the 4000 Saturdays website, 4000saturdays.com. This is one of a number of podcasts in the Part of the Solution series, which looks at humanity's greatest ever challenge, a continued and sustainable existence on our planet. This is a precursor to a documentary feature film called Part of the Solution, and if you're interested in finding out more about that, please visit 4000saturdays.com/movie. We're going to play out the rest of this track now, which is called Breathe by Urban Myth Club, taken from the album Helium. Thanks for your active listening.